Copples Western Cape Radio, CWCP, broadcasting from Worcester, South Africa.
Welcome to the Worcester Reports, a program of stories, Christian devotions, and music. Broadcast on CWCP, Copples Western Cape Radio.
South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God.
Welcome to the Worcester Reports. This is Tony Copple reporting. Lorianne will not be joining me today on this program, partly because she's been extremely busy working on accounts for an organization that she's involved in. I, however, had the opportunity to interview staff from Tuflug, a well-known rehab center located very conveniently between two of the townships here in Worcester, Avian Park and Riverview. I'd long wanted to go and find out more about them, and my opportunity came, and I made an appointment with manager Teresa Rousseau, and she kindly brought in two of her staff, so we had an animated conversation. The program has too much information to cram into one of our episodes, so we're going to split it into two. This week, we'll be concentrating on prevention in the whole world of drug and alcohol abuse. And I hope you'll find this useful information. You may want to share it with younger relatives if they're facing that time of life when people are ready to try anything without considering the consequences. Later in the program, we will be playing another episode in Legacy, the wonderful book on personal financial planning for yourself, your children, and your grandchildren, written by Jasper Cloete. And I will be reading from chapter 3. But first, Tuflug. Today, I'm at the Tuflug Center for Alcohol and Drug Dependence here in Worcester. This is an establishment that's been running for 40 years. It was founded in 1978. It does prevention, treatment, and aftercare. And there are 50 inpatients and 20 youth between the ages of 13 and 18. And I'm delighted to have three of the staff sitting with me today. I have Teresa Rousseau, who is the manager. I have Louise, who is a social worker. And I have Chrismy, who is a therapist. So we should be able to get answers to just about everything. So welcome to CWCP Radio, ladies.
Thank you very much.
Your website, which is a very good one, by the way, states that you work in prevention, treatment, and aftercare. And I want to spend most of our time talking about prevention, if that's okay with you, although we will talk about the others. I'm sure you all have opinions about problems that you are solving all the time, and I'm really looking forward to hearing your personal opinions. I don't need the politically correct answer, because I know that you've got experience that really counts. So, and if you want to tell stories or whatever, that'll also be fine. So the first question is very broad, but I think it can spark a conversation. Why do people with serious problems turn to drugs when all around them they see the results of drug dependency?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question to ask. And often when we get challenged with that question, we will ask people, but it's the same with every other thing. People are overweight, and you know all the bad consequences of being overweight, but still you eat everything that's in front of you. So very often, we're not so different from the addict. We also are motivated to lose weight, but then on the second day, when there's Coke in front of us, we like to drink the Coke. So it's not, if you think about that, it's not so different from any other bad habits that we have. But on another note, I think, and Chrismy and Louise must come in, I think there's a lot of factors that can lead up to addiction. And if we look at the preventative factors, I think it's in the house, the family ties, it's about joining religion. That plays a very important role. It's about the child, how they're doing in school. And in South Africa, there is a problem that people, children that are suffering in school, are not always identified and helped at an early age. Mm-hmm. And then they become a dropout in school, and then they start spiraling down the wrong road. Yeah, I don't know what you want to add, Louise and Chrismy.
Yeah, I think if we look at the biological reason of why people become addicted, it's because of the intense dopamine release in the brain. So when I explain it to our clients here in the center, it's like a treasure chest. All our valuables are put in a treasure chest. So even our good memories that we have is put in that treasure chest. And they have good memories of their using time. When they use, it's fun, there's fun activities, it's the consequences that are bad. So when they're feeling down or depressed or had a bad day, where do they go to? Where do they recall the fun from? So they open that treasure chest and then they opt for the drug again. So even though they know the consequences, they see what it does to communities, they have that intense longing to be happy. And because their dopamine decreases in their brain, so they don't experience happiness from normal things like good meals or family time or practicing a sport, they go back to the drug because they need that source that creates their happiness.
Yes, but at some time earlier than that, they made a decision to start. Mm. How common is it, in your experience, for people to say, no, I can see this would be a bad decision, I'm not even going to start. Mm. How common is that, or is that very uncommon?
I think that goes back to what Teresa said about the protective factors. If, especially the youngsters and young adults, if they have good role models, they are engaged in healthy activities, they give back to the community, they had a good education, they would be less likely to choose something that is harmful. Whereas if we look at a big part of the Vista community, it's the lack of role models. So it's not necessarily that the child is being naughty or willful or anything like that. It's just they don't know different. So they don't know that the example that's being said to them are wrong. And that is why they would sometimes, just out of the lack of education, opt for something like, well, my friends say they feel relaxed and focused when they smoke marijuana or cannabis, so why shouldn't I give it a try? I'm experiencing stress at home and this might help.
And
my parents are also using, because after working hours, my mother and my father asked me to buy beer, to buy cannabis just to relax because they are tired and easy accessible in the area, each and every corner of the street. There are people that are selling drugs, and each and every youth member, second house, third house, there is a drug merchant, there is a shebeen. So that's...
And for some people, it's an income, selling drugs. So very often we have patients that their parents are running a shebeen, or they are running their drug dealers, and that's the income. It's very difficult. It's challenging. I think what we also see is that children, if we speak about the youth, are living in terrible circumstances. We had just a case now that a young boy, he must stay outside his house and he get his food on the outside. He's not going to school. So it's very bad circumstances. And I think, yeah, it's easy to judge, but I think when you're in a situation where there's nothing that brings joy, then I think it's very easy to fall back or to fall to substances. Sometimes people self-medicate on drugs because there isn't, let's take a child that is actually ADHD. There is no medication, there's no assessment, and then the child will see, well, when I use stick or a stimulant, that helps me. To just forget about everything. I think the other thing that we didn't speak about is that Dacha, the laws are changing about Dacha, and what we see is a lot of messages going out that Dacha is okay.
I'm going to come back to that just a little bit later, because it's an important subject.
Yeah.
I think I need to explain to our listeners that you're hearing some chickens in the gardens. And I was totally surprised when I parked my car and I saw very healthy looking chickens with their chicks walking around the place. Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I don't know whose initiative that is. But.
We love our chickens.
Yes, we love our chickens.
We don't eat our chickens.
Okay, back to business. Do you know what the illegal drug industry in Worcester is worth?
Oh no, that will be very difficult to say.
I would say millions. Even if you do not even look at the drug itself, if you look at the areas that dealers are supplying to, just look at the trade, how many people are working, if you consider that in rand value, and how many households are being supported by the money that is being exchanged, I would say millions.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. I spend quite a lot of time in Avian Park and other places, and I'm sure that's true. Now, this is the thing that you just brought up. Some countries have legalized marijuana, Dhaka, including my own country, Canada. When I go back there, I'm expecting to find a whole bunch of addicts all over the place. What's your opinion as professionals about whether that is a good thing for a government to do or not?
As I start, I think South Africa is unique. We're not Canada, we're not any other land, country. And I think we sit with a lot of poverty, we sit with a lot of vulnerability, we sit with a lot of genetics of addiction. So what we see in the center is more and more psychiatric illnesses that is caused by the use of dhaka, especially in young children. Just last week we had a 19-year-old that is so sick, he thinks he's a vampire. And that is due to the long use from an early age of dhaka. And we're very concerned. I think I'm very concerned about the image of dhaka that is displayed. I think people underestimate this. For me, there's very clear evidence that for the adolescent brain, it's very, very harmful. And that is what we see.
Yeah, I think Teresa mentioned so well, we cannot compete with first world countries what legislation involves, because there are different laws that needs to support this thing around cannabis. We've got our justice law, we've got our mental health law, we've got our Substance Abuse Act, we have the Children's Act, and none of them are in line to protect everybody, to legislate this. If I'm correct, they can't even tell us how much marijuana or how big your plantation in your private garden or anything is by now, because they haven't decided on that yet. I don't think there's enough money for the police. There's not enough resources to administer the manpower, to look at our communities, to do the admin. Just to do the basic admin, when you find somebody who is not sticking to the law, who is going to check if there are no children in that private home where you're allowed to smoke cannabis?
And then a lot of children will tell you, yeah, dhaka is healthy, it's medicinal,
it's a herb.
But then we ask them, what is wrong with you? What illness do you have that you must use it? Because, So it's very, I think it's children is very educated these days. They read the internet and they think it's okay. And that is the message that is going out. But I think for our circumstances and for our youth,
it's a real concern when it comes to mental illnesses, I think. Is.
We live in a fairly close-knit community here in Worcester. As I drive around with teenagers from townships, they're shouting out of the windows to their friends. They know one another. Most of them are telling me stories about the other ones and so on. So in a community where people know one another, why do you think that from the point of view of the people who are selling the drugs or offering the drugs, that they can, in all conscience, try and hook young people on drugs when they know they can be wrecking their lives?
Sure, it's a difficult question.
As I said that, as Teresa mentioned earlier, that just because of the business, The people are like, they say that, okay, that's the way of living. I don't have any income. I will recruit each and every young person and sell drugs to them, whereas I know that at the end of the day, it will destroy themselves. It's my business, so...
So it's purely a financial decision.
Yes, yes. I will say so, because we are living in the poverty.
No conscience at all, even to introduce one of their close friends to it.
Yes.
You don't think they actually feel that they're doing harm?
I do believe they know, but it's just because they say that, okay, this is business and you have a choice to say no. So if you don't say no, as long as you're giving me money, so I will give it to you.
Okay.
And perhaps it's the norm.
Yes,
I think it's the norm. Everyone is doing it. So I think there is not a... If you do something and that's the way you do things, then it gets the norm. And
it's always been done.
It's always been done. My parents does it. So, and I think
in
that's
the community.
Thing.
It's part of the culture now, isn't
it?
Yes,
really. Yes,
so
yes.
So if you have a solid... If you have parents that is going to say, no, that's wrong... I think it will be much more difficult, but it's the norm. Everyone, and you know what? I think sometimes the vulnerable are getting target, and that's why that protective factor is like the child dropping out of school. He's the vulnerable one.
Mm.
He's the one that is getting easily hooked to that because he's a soft target. He can do the running. And then some parents tolerate it because it's an income.
Mm.
So I think it's a lot of factors playing a role, and I think especially when it comes to Doha, it's okay. I think we've got a lot of people are using. Why not?
Now, the people who are supplying the drugs, are they also using, or have they figured out in their minds that they can make more money if they don't use?
I think very few that are using. Most of them, they are not using.
Hmm.
They are just rich people driving nice cars, living that high lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I think in most cases, and it's not very different from what you see in the movies, is the boss is the one with the clear mind because he needs to run his business. He's got other people doing the work for him. If it's the running, if it's the making of the substance, packing, whatever. So I don't think necessarily that the merchant will be the one who uses. He needs to stay on top of things.
Yes.
I think there's a thrill in the business, no? Running the drugs. There's a little bit of dopamine also in that, no?
Mm.
Doing the wrong things.
Can education build a strong enough defense against giving in to drugs? You must run education programs here.
I think it's a holistic problem, and I think it's going to take what we need is every sector coming on board, whether it is the education department, it's that children mustn't leave school, it's the police to look at the availability of the drugs, it's the church to look at the morals and the values. It's education
parents.
Also.
Mm. It's parents.
It's parents.
Needing to step up.
It's the Department of Health, because what we see is that people are getting sicker and sicker due to the drug use. So it's becoming, we must break the cycle, and I know that's a cliche, but the cycle must be broken. So we believe that there's always hope, and we are a Christian facility, so we believe that people can... get well and people can change. We do believe that, but then it must be addressed holistically.
Yeah.
So very often it's a frustration for us. We have children coming into the center age 14 using drugs, and then they must go home to a house where the parents are still using drugs, and then you feel, why did they send the child and not the parents? So I think it's very complicated, but we do believe there's hope. I do believe education plays a part, but I do believe that people and children learn by what they see, what is healthy role models. And there's a lack, I think, of healthy role models.
Yeah. I was a financial planner, and I would tell my clients, I don't know if you know this, But if you stop smoking cigarettes at age 25 and put that money into an investment plan, by the age of 65, you will be a millionaire.
Wonderful.
Now, to me, that's an irrefutable argument. Yeah. I'd rather be a millionaire than a drug addict.
Yeah.
And yet people are hooked by then. And they only care about the immediate, you know, the immediate thing.
But isn't it because they don't see hope? They don't see a future? If you're a school dropout, for example, and you're too young to work because you're underage, no school wants you, what then? What is there for you if you have hope that you can become a lawyer or there's money to go and study and there's the ability to finish school? I think you have hope.
Yeah.
But if you've never been out of Worcester, for example, you never see a bigger picture, then I don't know what there is to look forward to. So it's easy if you have something to change for.
Yeah.
But if that isn't there, I don't know what you think, it's much more difficult if there's nothing to look forward to.
Yeah. Does TwoFlug run any education programs where you try and teach parents and children not to get on drugs in the first place, or if they are already on, to get off them? Do you actually run formalized classes in that area?
Yes, we do. We do the awareness campaigns to the schools around Worcester, and also when the patients are here, we call them patients, when they are here, we invite the families to be part of the program. And then we also teach them about the addiction, and then they also have an opportunity to attend each and every class with the patient so that they can be also aware about the addiction.
Mm.
And also what else?
Support groups.
We also do the support groups for the Worcester community. Everybody is welcome that is affected by the drug abuse, by the substance abuse.
Yeah. And we work together with all the other entities that is doing, that is focusing on prevention, and that is, we help the schools where we can with seeing children.
Have you got any feel for how effective these education classes are? Have you any way of measuring the effectiveness of them?
So it's very difficult because our main focus will be inpatient.
I think effectiveness can, that's how we look at our treatment as well when people talk about success rate. If we plan an event where we know, say, 50 people need to come and join the session, if all 50 come and they engage in the activities, we find that successful. But we have had activities that we even supply transport and something like to eat for the people, and they still don't pitch. So they're still not engaged in what we have to offer for free. So it's the flip side of the coin. We are very generous to offer the services, but the community is not always so keen to access it.
What is the best tool that you're aware of as individual workers to prevent people taking drugs in the first place?
A good plan. A good support plan, where you stick to your list of A to Z. What do I need? You need to firstly be able to identify what is the things I struggle with, what do I need support with, like triggers, and how do I cope and work with my cravings. Maybe I'm unemployed. If I have a list of things that I need to do and I can stick to do that, they do better. Routine. They do better. If they have visual aids to help them, say when they have a craving, they make a diverse rosary in the creativity department where there's 70 beads on them. So one of the things I tell them is, when you're experiencing a craving, take out your rosary, and then you start with 70 reasons why I shouldn't go and use now. Because then you can ride that wave, you can surf that urge, and by the time you get to 70, I'm sure that craving would be gone as well.
That's when you're using now, how to prevent a relapse.
Yes.
Yeah,
but just to state, not fall back. To relapse. Or if you know you can phone somebody, you have a solid support structure with significant others, where I know if I phone Mr. X, he's going to pick up, I will be able to talk to them.
I would say preventing I would say, don't start smoking cigarettes. Because very often, if you think of it simply, it's the child that starts with cigarettes that will go to the dacha and then to the mandrak. So I think that will be a, I think that's also something that we normalize. Now, it's okay for children to smoke cigarettes. They can smoke in the school clothes, next to the school. And I think that's where things sometimes start. And then life skills. We need to teach our children life skills, how to cope with stress, how to cope with problems, sleeping habits, we need to teach them self-discipline. Mm. We need to, good parenting.
All goes back to the parents.
Parenting skills.
It's not a, if you have a, you can be a good parent and still your children use drugs, but at least it is protective. It's a preventative measure that you can take. Look at mental health. Sometimes when we're depressed, sometimes when we're anxious, we go to things, the wrong things.
Do you see religion, faith, being powerful here in terms of giving them something else to have in their hearts instead of the god of a drug?
Yeah.
It's always interesting to listen to their stories as they progress in the treatment program, where they would 99% of the time say that they are so thankful for Tuflich and that we are a Christian organization, because that was the first thing that went when they started using, is their belief in God. So they found God again and they enjoyed being engaged in spiritual activities, and in the morning we open with devotionals and sing quirkies, that's like little short hymns. So definitely religion plays a big part. We have also found people that were not spiritual at all because they were angry at God, and then they made peace with God while they were here and started practicing their religion and their spiritual life again.
Yeah, even during our support groups, when we have old patients, the ones that they were here, they usually mention that without God, you won't be successful in your recovery. And most of them, they had most drug friends. And then when they start attending the church services and church activities, they meet new people and they build a new friendship with the sober and drug-free people. So they mentioned that it's also helped them. So I agree with them that religion plays a very big role.
Certainly in the prisons, we find this. The prisoners will always tell you that the only way they were able to get off the drugs was through their new faith. I don't know anything more powerful myself as terms of a therapy.
But it's also difficult. Patients experience it. Sometimes difficult to go back to church because they feel embarrassed and they feel that they're not good enough and judge. I think that's also a message for the people in the church, that we must open our arms for people that went on the wrong path, and try and understand a little bit of addiction. As I said, if you think about yourself, there's things that we want to change that we don't succeed in, and that's the same with the addict. So I think we can have a little bit more empathy with addiction and open our arms for the people and try to understand how difficult it is. I had a discussion once with a girl that was in school, and I said to her, but why didn't you, because you don't have any positive things that you do to keep you out of trouble, why didn't you go to the church group, RCFFA, what they call it in church? And she said to me, no, they all rich and she won't fit in there. And I just felt, it's so sorry, it's so sad actually, that people feel that they don't fit into a church because they're not good enough. That's actually sad. Yeah. So I think it's very often, what do you mean, a randfiguur? It's very often the people that are not like the usual people, the people on the edge of the, I don't know how you say that in English, that is suffering because they're not being drawn into something, whether it's the church or sport activities. It's society. So we must not push people to the edge of society. So our logo will be set free to live. So So we will try and set people free to live. And we believe that religion is a very important role. And we also believe that religion is a very protective factor when you raise your children and for a relapse. If your religion is there, it can be.
Chrismy, if somebody has been an addict on hard drugs for 20 years and then they stop through any method, mm-hmm. and some people have stopped cold turkey that way, can they then live a normal life? Can they completely get not have effects of being an addict for 20 years?
So I believe that addiction is a brain disease. So for somebody who has been using for 20 years, it has not just stuck to harmful use where you can actually still make your U-turn. So that person needs to acknowledge that I had a problem if they stop after 20 years, and I need to manage this like I would if I had diabetes or hypertension. And then I go back to where I said about having your set of rules for yourself, where I need to stick to these things, going to church, going to my support groups, taking my mental health meds, getting enough sleep, eating healthy, whatever it may be, and that will keep them sober. Yes, lapses happen. Sometimes you might experience 30 years after you've stopped a traumatic experience, and then going back to that treasure chest, what gave me that instant happiness when I felt so down? And then they might use again. But it's not about the use itself. It's about getting up and going back to your list and doing it all over again.
And for anyone who tuned in late, you can hear the rest of that interview, another 15 minutes worth or so, on next week's Worcester Report. Jasper Clote's book, Legacy, is a masterly treatise on how to plan your life from a financial point of view that takes into account the independence of your children and your children's children. It's a biblical concept that greatly repays further study. So I am reading from that book from time to time. We've had two sections so far. On January the 10th, I read the introduction and chapter 1. On January the 17th, I read chapter 2, and now we will have chapter 3. So if this catches your attention, go to our podcast and listen to the previous part of the book. I'm not sure when we will read further parts. It's whenever we have space in our program. But it will highly repay you to do so. And I don't just mean metaphorically. Legacy, Chapter 3, Legacy as a House, Laying a Solid Foundation for Three-Generational Wealth Creation. Government, churches, and social support organizations are investing millions into support and upliftment programs that are aimed at helping people and communities to improve their lot in life. The problem with most of these programs are twofold. 1. The upliftment programs are generally seen by the recipients as being imposed upon them. They have not personally bought into the various causes and are not committed to them. There is no doubt that a lot of good has come from these efforts, but they do seem to be unsustainable. As soon as the funding dries up or the government or organizations withdraw their support, the programs die a slow death. 2. Most of these programs are designed around a solution of one size fits all. The reality, however, is that people are very different, have different skills and desires, come from different cultures and backgrounds, and therefore cannot be handled on a basis of one size fits all. The gig movement is about creating a new people group around the generational message. Since we come from different backgrounds, skills, cultures and religions, we need to develop a new language for this new mindset. For this reason, we have developed the concept of legacy as a house. The Bible refers to the generations of various leaders as the house of Abraham or the house of David. This does not refer to a physical house, but rather to the process that God started with this specific family and the anointing and special purpose he had for this family that played out over many successive generations. The symbol of a physical house is applied to explain the process that each three-generational family will need to use to build a lasting legacy for their family. You should now continue to listen to the rest of this chapter from a perspective of you building your family legacy as a house. Refer to this house as the house of, and insert your family name here. In your mind's eye, imagine you see a picture of a three-generational family symbolized as a house. Visualize your own family within this diagram. At the top, there is a roof of worth. On the left-hand side, there is a wall of well-being. On the right-hand side, there's a wall of wealth. At the bottom, there is a floor of wisdom. And in the center, there are family dreams and goals. Houses in any area or suburb look completely different from each other. They vary in size, number of rooms, internal layout, shape and height of the roof and interior, and exterior painting and decorations. Through skillful and godly wisdom is a house, a life, a home, a family, built. And by understanding, it is established on a sound and good foundation. And by knowledge shall its chambers of every area be filled with all precious and pleasant riches. Proverbs 23:3 in the Amplified Bible. Although our legacy houses may differ substantially from one another, the common denominator in the Geek movement is that we all have to build our houses and follow the same building process and use the same construction methods and material. When we get together in our groups for our weekly and monthly training events, we build our themes and discussions around the framework of legacy as a house. We hereby equip everyone with the necessary tools and building materials, but what the individual makes with it is that individual's own prerogative. Building a lasting legacy is not something that happens in a week, a month, or even years. It takes the lifetime of the founder and after him the lifetimes of the successive generations. Let us take time to understand the various components and processes of building a legacy house. Foundation of wisdom. Wisdom refers to the foundational philosophy on which you build your decisions and actions. It is sad to see how one-generational parents pursue short-term wealth and security, in the process getting stuck on the treadmill of the system, which results in them losing their wealth, health, and relationships. As the founder of your family dynasty, you must make very sure that the wisdom philosophy you follow will stand the test of time. Since, when we start, the responsibility of becoming the founding parents, we come from differing age groups, religions, cultures, and nationalities, we need to ask ourselves three very important questions. 1. Has this wisdom philosophy worked before and produced the desired results? 2. Has it worked for more than one person? Anything can work for one person once. 3. Has it worked over a long period of time, for more than one generation? You will probably agree that if we can find affirmative answers to the above questions, we are safe in adopting that wisdom philosophy also for our families. The good news is there is such a historical example. Many thousands of years ago, the forefathers of the Jewish nation found themselves as slaves for a period of 400 years, more than 10 generations of family. Imagine how it must have been to be born within such a family where your father is a slave who daily had to endure physical and verbal abuse whilst doing manual labor, while your mother worked from early morning till late in the evening to provide a home as best she can do and to prepare a meager meal with what is available. Imagine being there and listening to your parents and grandparents sitting around the fire in the evening and sharing stories of abuse and hardship, then training you, the youngest growing child, to be prepared for a life of slavery. Don't challenge authority, or you'll just get more hidings. Don't make eye contact. It can be mistaken for aggression. Be satisfied with the little we have. At least we are still alive. Don't be ambitious. Remember, you're just a slave. We are just slaves and can't make decisions for ourselves. Get used to the life of a slave. This is who we are. My father was a slave. My grandfather was a slave. All my family generations, going as far back as I can remember, were slaves. Then God sent Moses to deliver his people by sending plagues on the Egyptians, and soon this ragtag bunch of slaves found themselves in the isolation of the desert, with untold wealth given to them by the Egyptians, but still stuck in a slave mentality. For the next 40 years, God downloaded a new wisdom and kingdom philosophy to his people. Unfortunately, the old generation found it too radically different from what they were used to and rejected it. God had to wait until the last of the old generation with their old thinking had died out, except Moses, Joshua, and Caleb, before he led them into the promised land through Joshua. God gave them their promised land, but they still had to personally fight and destroy the giants in the land. By following this new wisdom kingdom philosophy and passing it on to future generations who did the same, they not only took possession of the land, but about 200 years later, under the reign of King Solomon, they became the richest, most feared nation on the earth at that time. Wealth for the citizens of Jerusalem became so abundant that, as it states in 1 Kings 10 verse 27, the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedars as plentiful as the sycamore trees in the lowlands. To put this into perspective, consider this. If I pick up a handful of dirt on the side of the street and place it in your lap, will it excite or offend you? Offend you, right? Now this is how the poorest of the poor felt when someone gave them a bag of silver in the time of King Solomon. The point here is not about the wealth, but how the right philosophy can change a nation, city, and family. If we look at the history of the Jewish nation and how God turned it around, the questions for us today are we currently living as slaves, bonded by a one-generational system designed to keep us poor and dependent on government intervention? For how many generations have we been living like this? Are we happy to continue living like this? Or are we ready to start the journey to move from a one-generational mindset to a three-generational mindset? Are we ready to become the founding parents of our family dynasty and learn and apply the same philosophy that turned a bunch of slaves into a wealthy nation? In the gig movement, we have developed in-depth lessons and workshops to bring every member into an understanding of this generational philosophy. Introductory material on some of these lessons is available on www.gig-institute.com. Wall of Wealth. Wealth refers to the theory of wealth. All the things one needs to know and master if he wishes to become wealthy. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Hosea chapter 4 verse 6 in the Amplified Bible. What we don't know can still cause us harm. Enduring poverty is often related to lack of education and knowledge. The best investment any individual can ever make is to invest in themselves, to gain more knowledge and understanding. Regardless of the individual's profession or business, if they wish to build enduring wealth, they must become knowledgeable on the following. How to sell. How to market, how to manage resources of time, money, people skills, communication skills, how to communicate your ideas verbally or in writing, presentation skills, leadership skills, financial skills, basic financial literacy, preparing a business plan. These subjects were not taught in school in my time. I don't know if things have changed since then. One can attend private or university courses for each of the above subjects, but most people study just hard enough to get a job. Few people take the step to start their own businesses and develop the entrepreneurial skills needed to succeed at it. In the gig movement, we have developed training on these various topics which is available to members. Wall of well-being. Knowledge is applied learning. All the training in the world helps you not one jot if you do not apply it. Well-being is that part of building our legacy house where we become practical about the theory. We believe that there is a business waiting to be started by every family. Many times, however, you may come from a non-business family and therefore you do not consider yourself a business person. By allowing yourself to be exposed to the language of wealth, associating with like-minded people in the local gigs, and volunteering for certain tasks in gig in order to get exposure, we believe every individual will soon find themselves developing a vision or idea of a business. One of the first things we encourage our gig members to do is to start an entrepreneurs club in their local gig. In this club, they pool their money, jointly explore needs that can be turned into business opportunities in their community, organize themselves in a corporate structure with an MD, managing director, secretary, who does administration and minutes of meetings, treasurer, who does accounting and finance. They are advised to keep circulating these responsibilities among themselves to give everyone an opportunity to get exposure and experience in that role. Start businesses and share in the risk and reward of these businesses. Members who actively participate in these local gigs and start these clubs soon find themselves benefiting personally in their own family quest for wealth. Further training material on the well-being part, as well as constant exposure to different business ideas and opportunities, are made available to gig members. Roof of worth. Your worth as a family legacy is tied to your family purpose and anointing. Anointing in this context refers to the special gifts you have as a family. Some families tend to have a passion for health care, such as doctors and nurses, others for ministry, pastors, public sermons, and others for business and job creation. Within a family, the various children will each have a special calling. For example, one is good in sports, another in arts or a profession such as architect, doctor, accountant, etc. To know your specific family purpose, and as an individual, it is important to develop a personal relationship with your Creator. No human being can tell you what you should become and what your purpose is. For every one of us, it is a lifelong working it out to figure out what it is you like and don't like, what you are good at, and in what areas of your life you need the help of others. Work out, cultivate, carry out to the goal, and fully complete your own salvation with reverence and awe and trembling, self-distrust, with serious caution, tenderness of conscience, watchfulness against temptation, timidly shrinking from whatever might offend God and discredit the name of Christ. Not in your own strength, for it is God who is all the while effectively at work in you, energizing and creating in you the power and desire, both to will and to work for his good pleasure and satisfaction and delight. 8 Philippians 2, verses 12 and 13 in the Amplified Bible. The shape of the roof is a good symbolic illustration of this working it out principle. The top of the roof points up and illustrates the personal relationship each person must have with his Creator to establish his unique purpose on earth. Please note that we don't refer here to belonging to a church or religion, but we do believe we are each created for a purpose, and only our Creator can reveal that purpose to the person who develops a personal relationship with Him. We challenge you to start talking to Him as you would talk to your earthly father and ask His advice on your life's issues and see what happens. The bottom portion of the roof is flat and symbolizes that once you have heard, sense of knowing, what your purpose is, to then practically work it out by taking daily action steps towards that purpose. Our purpose doesn't only relate to a specific gift, but also to the variety of roles we each have to perform in order to build a functioning family and community. Roles such as be a father or mother, be a brother or sister, be a friend, be an employer. The various topics we train on within the gig movement include Maslow's hierarchy of needs, love languages, personality types, various family roles and responsibilities. Now that you understand the various components that go into building a legacy as a house, it is time to take the next step and become active. Know that it may well take you your entire lifetime to build the first basic house. When you finish your journey, your children will then come and add to the basic structure by adding more rooms. When they die, their children will come and add another story to the house. And so the legacy house of, insert your family name here, will grow from generation to generation. Gratia, the second movement of Ecce Cor Meum by Paul McCartney, brings our program to a close, other than the regular half hour of soaking music, which we hope you'll take advantage of. My name is Tony Koppel, and I thank you for listening. God bless you all.
Koppel's Western Cape Radio, CWCP, broadcasting from Worcester, South Africa.